We are going to study the book of Matthew. Got through the whole Old Testament. Now we're going to start looking through the books of the New Testament and seeing how they are laid out. Each of the Gospels accounts focus on different audience and present the life of Jesus in a different style. They're eyewitness accounts, but they're basically done in different ways to reach different people and to express different purposes. We're going to focus on the Gospel of Matthew tonight. Gospel is also known as Levi. He's a tax collector. In Matthew chapter 9, and in verse 9 it says, Jesus went on from there, and he saw a man called Matthew sitting in the tax collector's booth, and he said to him, follow me, and he got up and followed him. Mark also has that same account, is in Mark chapter 2, and in verse 14, Mark chapter 2, and in verse 14, as he passed, he saw Levi, the son of Alphaeus, sitting in the tax booth, and he said to him, follow me, and he got up and followed him. So this is how we know Matthew has two names. One's Levi, one's Matthew. We know his father's name is Alphaeus. Events that might give praise to the author, if you'd actually look in the various Gospels, each of the Gospels, the author who is writing it, tends to not name themselves if it gives them credit or gives them praise. And so, for instance, in the Gospel of John, all the time you see John referring to himself as the disciple whom Jesus loved. How do we know who that was? Well, we go to the parallel accounts, and they all say John. But in John's own account, he just says the disciple whom Jesus loved. And the same thing happens in Matthew. In Matthew, going back to Matthew 9, in verse 10, right after Jesus calls him, Matthew 9, verse 10, it says, then it happened as Jesus was reclining at the table in the house, behold, many tax collectors and sinners came and were dining with Jesus and his disciples. So we find out there's a feast at a house. But it doesn't say whose house, where Jesus was having his dinner at. It's not until we get to Luke chapter 5, where a parallel account is given. Luke 5 and verse 29, it says, and Levi gave a big reception for him at his house, and there was a great crowd of tax collectors and other people who were reclining at the table with them. Now notice, when Luke mentions it, Matthew's account just says there was a dinner at the house. But it doesn't say whose house or really how big of a dinner it was. But you get to Luke's account and it's a big feast with lots of people that were pulled in that Matthew had brought in. And because of that, then that's one of the reasons why we suspect that Matthew would be the writer of Matthew. But actually, there's really no doubt Matthew's always been attributed to the book Gospel of Matthew. All the early copies that we have of Matthew have a title on them, and they all say the Gospel of Matthew. All the early Christian writers, even those that go back to the time when they were basically as children living at the time of the apostles, or would have been basically their fathers would have been living at the time of the apostles, they all say the Gospel is by Matthew. So there's really no controversy there, other than maybe sometimes you'll run across some modern day writer who wants to make some type of controversy so he can make his mark in the sand to say that he has done something different. But other than that, there really is no controversy as far as who wrote the Gospel of Matthew. Now, as far as dating the Gospel, one of the early writers is Irenaeus, and he says, Matthew published his Gospel among the Hebrews in their own language, while Peter and Paul were preaching and founding the church in Rome. After their departure, Mark, the disciple and interpreter of Peter, also transmitted to us in writing those things which Peter had preached. And Luke, the attendant of Paul, recorded in the book the gospel which Paul had declared. Afterwards, John, the disciple of the Lord, who also reclined on the bosom, published his gospel while staying at Ephesus in Asia. So Irenaeus, depending on how accurate you want to consider him, said, okay, you know, here's the various gospels. He names all four of them. And he also names their sources. Mark was basically writing down the memories of Paul or Peter. Luke says, was heavily been influenced by what Paul said. And then we got John and we got Matthew's accounts as well. In another book, that's by Eusebius, he says again, in the same books, Clement gives the tradition of the earliest presbyters as to the orders of the Gospels. In the following manner, the Gospels containing the genealogies, he said, were written first. That would be Matthew and Luke. The Gospel according to Mark had this occasion, as Peter preached the word publicly at Rome and declared the Gospel by the Spirit, many who were present requested that Mark, who had followed him for so long and remembered his sayings, should write them out. And having composed the gospel, he gave it to those who requested it. When Peter learned of this, he neither directly forbade it or encouraged it. But last of all, John, perceiving that the external facts had been made plain in the gospel, being urged by his friends and inspired by the Spirit, composed a spiritual gospel. So, and you actually do see this in John. John does make mention, seeing that there are already accounts, and John basically focus those on details that the other Gospels really don't give. There's a few things they overlap. But John's more focused on Jesus' teachings, the spiritual content. And because he knows about the other ones, he didn't overlap what other people already said. But it's interesting that Eusebius, or actually Clement, says that elders prior to him told him that it was the Gospels that had the genealogies were first, and then Mark, and then John. Because that's fascinating, because if you look at modern day dates for the Gospels, almost everybody puts Mark first. And the question is, why Mark first? Because Mark's shortest. And everybody has this idea that, well, things have to develop. And so there's this strong urge to say, okay, we start with the shortest, and traditions add on as time goes on. Because after all, that's the way men work. But that doesn't make it true. It's an interesting theory, but it doesn't always play out in facts. Most of the time it doesn't play out in facts. Now, in Matthew, if we want to actually date the book, in Matthew 27, and in verse 8, in telling some things, says, talking about in this case the potter's field where Judas hanged himself. It says, for this reason, that field has been called the field of blood to this day. That phrase "to this day" is important. Also, take a look at Matthew 28 and verse 15. And they took the money, and they did as instructed, talking about the guards that were to spread a false report. And it says, and this story was widely spread among the Jews and is to this day. Again, that same phrase. What that tells us is Matthew wasn't written immediately after the events. To say "to this day" means that he's saying there is a gap between the events and when he wrote it. There's at least some significant gaps that he can say, even to this day, it's still continuing. If you wrote it a week afterwards, you know, of course rumors still fly around. Of course people still call the field of blood. But now if it's 20 years later, then that becomes significant. People are still up to that time saying it. Okay. So that gives us one thing. We know it's not immediately after the events. There's also, while Matthew goes through and says, here's prophecies that are being fulfilled, and gives heavy emphasis on it, there are prophecies about the destruction of Jerusalem, like in Matthew 24. Okay. And yet, there's no mention of the temple actually being destroyed. There's no little side comment like to this day about the temple being destroyed. In fact, we know that the authors of the gospel were selective of what events they recorded. And Matthew makes mention, for instance, in Matthew 17, verse 24, and we're not going to take time to read it, but in that passage, starting there, he talks about the paying of the temple tax. Well, that record of that shows that the way it's written is that it was probably still going on at the time. There's no mention of it being something that was passed and no longer applicable. Because the question was, do Christians pay the temple tax? And Jesus basically makes mention of that. In fact, on that note, the temple, the worship there is referred to frequently. And again, while there's prophecies to this destruction, there's no indication that it changed by the time Matthew recorded Matthew. Now, that doesn't mean that's not proof, but it kind of tells us that probably Matthew is written before 70 AD when Jerusalem was destroyed. Because it would have been a significant event. It would have been something to say. You know, Jesus prophesied this and hey, it did happen. But those are not mentioned. Given that, and for some variety of other reasons, given some of the early Christian writers saying, hey, they were close to the events, they probably know a little more than we do 2,000 years afterwards, then we probably would put Matthew's account probably was written in the 50s. Probably, most people want to put it in the late 50s, but somewhere in the 50s probably it was written. Now that, if you look at modern day writers, as far as the critics of the Bible, they'll put it 80 to 100, 110, 120. They put it after the destruction of Jerusalem. Why? Because it has prophecies about the destruction that are too detailed. And they look at it and say, there's no way Matthew could have wrote those unless he was writing after the fact. Basically claiming that it wasn't inspired. But since we don't look at it that way, and realizing that if it was there, Matthew would have said it had come about, it looks more that it was written beforehand. Now, as far as the language, one of the writers mentioned that Matthew was written in the Hebrew language. And actually the words that are used, it was written in Latin, that original statement. The words that are used actually can also be translated into Hebrew dialect or in the Hebrew style. Some people long cited Papias, an early Christian writer who said that Matthew was originally written in Hebrew. But like I said, it can be stated as a Hebrew dialect or a Hebrew style of writing. If we look at Matthew, we can actually figure this out, whether it was written in Greek originally or written in Hebrew. Because all we have to do is look at Matthew 27. If we look at that passage in verse 33, it says, "And when they came to a place called Golgotha, which means the place of the skull," well, Golgotha is an Aramaic term. If it was written in Aramaic, you don't translate Aramaic into Aramaic. You don't explain Aramaic in Aramaic. So this tells us it was written in a different language than Golgotha, the Aramaic term. And the explanation is it makes sense in Greek. Another example of this is in the same chapter down in verse 46. In about the ninth hour, Jesus cried out in a loud voice saying, "Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani," that is, my God, why have you forsaken me? That one is written in Hebrew. And again, it's translated for us. It's not written in Hebrew originally because there wouldn't be a need to translate that statement in the language it was originally there. It was written originally in a different language. It's a simple test. But it's amazing how many people ignore it and claim it's written in another language. We know that early Christians made many, many copies of the original documents. That's why we have so many of them. We got literally 5,000 plus of documents. And I've lost track how many fragments. It's like close to 8,000, 10,000 fragments. So the original Christians made lots of copies. But what's interesting, among all the copies that we have, there are no Hebrew or Aramaic versions of Matthew that appeared until very much later. There are no early copies. And those Hebrew and Aramaic translations that are there are translations from the Greek. People who are skilled in languages can look at something and say, well, this was originally written in this language and was translated over because of the idioms and the difficulties of translating from one language to another. They can oftentimes pinpoint what the original language was written in. And they all say, no, these ones that we have in Hebrew and Aramaic, they came from the Greek translation, the Greek version of Matthew. People suppose there is an earlier Aramaic version or a Hebrew version, but we have no record of it. We have no copies of it. And like I said, if you look at Matthew itself, it shows that it wasn't written in those languages. In fact, most people who are skilled in languages look at Matthew and say, it reads the most fluid in Greek. But it has a Jewish style to it. It's aimed at a Jewish audience. In fact, we know it's aimed at a Jewish audience because there's the other problem also. In Matthew chapter 5, and in verse 22, we also see some things that Matthew does in his writings. But I say to you, everyone who is angry at his brother shall be guilty before the court, and whoever says to his brother, you good for nothing, or most of your translations say reka, which is what it says in the thing, shall be guilty before the Supreme Court, and whoever says, you fool, shall be guilty enough to go into the fiery hell. The word reka appears there. It's an Aramaic term. But in this particular case, it's not translated. So again, come away with is Matthew was expecting some people to know, the ones at least he's targeting his audience to, probably understood some Aramaic. And he didn't bother to translate the small words. So what we conclude then is Matthew was originally written in Greek, but it's heavily in a Jewish style. Now, as far as the purpose of the book, Matthew's account starts out with the genealogy of Jesus, starting at Abraham, and emphasizing the relationship of Jesus to David. Facts that were very important to the Jews who were looking for the coming Messiah, who knew that he would be of the lineage of David, who knew he would be a descendant of Abraham. We also know that Matthew, we read his account, he by far does the most quoting of the Old Testament of the other Gospels. He quotes the Old Testament more often than the other Gospels combined. In fact, he also very frequently says, you know, this was to fulfill this prophecy. And he mentions some event. This event was here to fulfill some prophecy. I think that phrase appears like 12 times in Matthew. So, from that we then gather that Matthew's audience is the Jewish people. He's trying to prove to the Jews about the Christ, to give them the information that they need. Another thing also we find in Matthew is there's very frequent mentions of the kingdom. And Christ as being king. So in fact, what we see as an overview of Matthew is that there's a layout of events proving that Jesus is king that's interleaved with teachings about the kingdom itself. It's not a chronological account. It's a topical account. But it's presented in a loosely chronological order. The topics are picked basically in a chronological order, but they're not each one exactly in the time period they actually occurred. Just roughly, loosely in that time period. In fact, each section, as we go through it, as we mentioned the various sections, what you'll find, especially at the end of the, where there's a discourse, a large teaching, it will end with the words, when Jesus had finished these words, and then we start a new section. There's actually five of these discourses in Matthew. And each of the discourses is about some topic about the kingdom. And interleaved with it is then events about Jesus' life that prove that Jesus is the king. So the first section of Matthew basically introduces us to the king. And it gives the foundation to say, this is the Messiah. It starts out in chapter 1 for the first 17 verses to show his lineage, to show that he inherited David's throne. The second half of Matthew chapter 1 then shows his birth, showing his recognition by God. Because God announced his birth. That's important. Because God's saying, this is the son that I have prophesied. So we got the evidence of his genealogy and the evidence of God announcing his birth. It then, in chapter 2, talks about Jesus' childhood. And that basically again tells us he's recognized by leaders in the world. Wise men come all the way to see the Christ. Herod's trying to wipe him out. He recognizes, in a backwards way, that this is the king. Because he's trying to stop him from growing up. In Matthew 3, what we mostly remember about that one is the baptism of Jesus. But what we really need to come away with and understand what's there, the important part of Matthew 3 is the fact that the Spirit came upon Jesus. This was Jesus' anointing. Because the Messiah, or the word Christ, means the anointed one. When did Jesus get anointed? That was at his baptism. And he was anointed by God himself as the Spirit came upon him. That's evidence that's important. Then we get to Matthew chapter 4, in the first part, from verses 1 through 11, it talks about his testing, showing his ability to defeat Satan. He's unlike any other man. And the end of Matthew 4 then starts talking about his teachings and his miracles. God's with him. That introduces us to the king. And what's the next section? We flip over now, we got a discussion, what we know as the Sermon on the Mount, from Matthew 5 to Matthew 7. And if you read through it, that whole discourse, even though it takes up, you know, three chapters, and it looks like, you know, from our viewpoint, it's a long chapter. If you actually read it out loud, it only takes about 15 minutes to say the whole thing. But that discourse packs huge quantities of information about the laws of the kingdom. It starts out with the Beatitudes, which really serve in a very similar function as the Ten Commandments did to the Old Law. And it gives the laws, it gives how the kingdom is to operate. Then from in Matthew 8 to verse chapter 9, we go back to Jesus again. By the way, if you look at the very end of 8 or end of 7, I think it is, in verse 28, it says, when Jesus had finished these sayings. There's the end of that first section. Matthew 8 and 9 begin telling us about the power of the king. A diverse set of miracles are described. These are not all taking place in that chronological order, but Matthew's selecting a bunch. And he's doing it on purpose. He's showing us miracles, showing that he has power over diseases. He has power over nature. He has power over demons. He has power over injuries. He has power over birth defects. He even has power over death. This is not a, even like the prophets of old, who show the ability to do some miracles. Jesus is showing miracle after miracle after miracle, and Matthew's laying down, look at these and how broad they are. And how much is covered here. This is the power of the king. The healings, if you look at each one, they're all done in different ways. Some are by touch, some are by just words. One's there, he wasn't even present. He wasn't even close. He just said, go back home. And that person was made well. Different ways. Some required faith on the person's part, some didn't at all. Person didn't even know who they were dealing with. The variety is there to show us the power of the king. And interspersed all the way through there are little nuggets showing Jesus' wisdom in his teachings. But then we get to another discourse. And it's in Matthew chapter 10. And this discourse basically is one about the citizens of the kingdom. What's required of them. What it means to be a citizen. The first part is really focused on the apostles, but as it goes on, it becomes broader. It tells how the kingdom is going to be spread by the teachings of his people. How they're going to face persecution. And how they need to be dedicated and devoted in order to accomplish the task that Jesus is going to set out for them. And again, that discourse ends and when Jesus finished these words. And we get to chapter 11. Actually, I think that when Jesus finished these things, it's actually the first verse of chapter 11, if you notice that. And that ends the second section. In the 11 and 12, what we have is illustrations of Jesus' ability to make judgments. Any king sits in judgment. And here we have a variety of sets of different events. Jesus answers questions from John the Baptist himself, whom the people recognize as a prophet. He answers questions from the Pharisees. We see him rebuking those who won't change and showing great wisdom and being able to penetrate right to the core of whatever issue is presented to him. That's followed by, in Matthew 13, the first part of Matthew 13, a whole series of parables. Again, these parables weren't said one after the other necessarily. Matthew's collecting them from this period of time to give us an illustration. These are parables about the kingdom. What the kingdom is like. It's telling us the nature of what the kingdom is like. Each one of the parables. The kingdom of heaven is like unto. And it goes on to tell us what the kingdom is like. And what we also see here is something about Jesus' wisdom again. He's showing wisdom that's more subtle than even Solomon's. Solomon taught by parables. Solomon taught by words of Proverbs. The parables that Jesus gives, though, are of a class all to themselves. Starting then in the last part of Matthew 13, from verse 53 and all the way to Matthew 17, verse 26, depending on where you want to actually break it at, we again find focus on Jesus himself, on the king. Now we find there is resistance to this king. He has detractors. We find, for instance, in Matthew 13, verses 53 to 58, that he's rejected by his own hometown. In Matthew 14, first 12 verses, John's killed by those, and how that impacts Jesus itself. The Pharisees and the Sadducees in two different things. One at the beginning of 15, one at the beginning of 16. They're coming and challenging Jesus. They're not just asking questions now. They're actually challenging Jesus. You don't really know what you're talking about. And trying to prove that he doesn't. Failing in the attempts, but they're trying to. But interspersed also all the way through here are great miracles that show the king's compassion. We also find that there is also in the middle here the great confidence the disciples had in Jesus. This is where we find Jesus asking, who do people say that I am? And Peter answering, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. But not only that, we got in Matthew 17, in the same section, God himself saying, this is my beloved Son. Hear him. We also see in this section, Jesus trying to prepare his disciples for his death, telling them he's going to die. They don't understand, they don't comprehend it, they keep rejecting it, but Jesus is trying to get them ready for what's coming up. There's resistance to the king, and things are going to come to an end. And they need to know this. But that section is followed by another discourse in chapter 18. It's a discourse about relationships in the kingdom. And if you actually go through it, it's talking about how important everyone is in the kingdom. The need for forgiveness. You can't just get mad at somebody and throw them out. You need to work out problems. You gotta watch for the little ones, the weak ones. Let them grow up. That's the first part of chapter 18. All the way through there, there's talking about the relationships between the members of the kingdom and how the kingdom has to work together. Then we get to chapter 19 and going on then to chapter 24. It talks about the king. And now we see the difficulties people have in accepting him as king. What we find in this section is very hard teachings from Jesus. Teachings about, for instance, Matthew 19 about divorce, which the disciples said, hey, if this is true, forget this whole idea of marriage. We find other difficult teachings that people just seem like they just can't take it. They can't handle it. There are requests that come up, like for instance from James and John's mother, saying make these basically your right hand and left hand man in your kingdom. They're turned down. Sinners are thrown out of the temple. There are stories given all the way through here that illustrate the fact that he's going to be rejected. But in there also, almost as a complete contrast, is the story of Jesus' triumphant entry and how the people welcomed him into Jerusalem. But as he goes into Jerusalem, we find yet another discourse. This one's talking about, it starts from Matthew 23, and it's not verse, from Matthew 23 down through Matthew 25. It starts out with a discourse on how the Pharisees and the leaders of the Jews at this time had corrupted the religion, and how woe was going to be pronounced on them, and it ends up at the end of Matthew 23, basically saying, Jerusalem is going to get destroyed. Matthew 24 has the disciples showing them the glories of the Jerusalem, and again Jesus says that Jerusalem is going to be destroyed. 23 gives the reasons. 24 says here's how it's going to happen. And it goes from 24 down, verse 1 down to verse 35. It's going to be destroyed. And eventually, everything's going to come to an end. Jerusalem's going to come to an end, but the world will eventually one day come to an end as well. And so the citizens of the kingdom here are being told they need to be ready. You cannot get lax. You cannot say, well, it's going to keep going the way it always has. You have to be prepared. And the last part of 24 all the way through 25, that's the theme all the way through. You have to be ready at any moment, at any time, because we don't ever know when the world is going to end. Then we switch back over to the king again. And we're given proof again that he is the king. There's the death, the burial, and the resurrection that gives absolute evidence that Jesus was and is the Messiah. And it goes from Matthew 26, verse 1, down to verse 15 of Matthew 28. And then just the last few verses of Matthew 28 show us the kingdom being established. It's the shortest of the statements that are made. But going to Matthew 28, starting with verse 16, but the 11 disciples proceeded to Galilee, to the mountain which Jesus had designated. And when they saw them, they worshipped him, but some were doubtful. And Jesus came up and spoke to them, saying, all authority has been given to me in heaven and on earth. Go therefore and make disciples of all the nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit, teaching them to observe all that I commanded you. And lo, I am with you always, even to the end of the age. The kingdom was established. And that's what the book of Matthew is about. It's proving to the Jews that Jesus was a king, proving to the Jews that there is a new kingdom with different laws, superior laws, compared to the old one. Better principles. And teaching the church about how to live. In fact, Matthew was probably one of the commentators I ran across mentioned Matthew was probably one of the most popular among the early Christians. It's the one that's most often cited. There is so much in Matthew to tell people what the church was really about. In fact, Matthew, by the way, is the only one that uses the word church in his account, as well as the word kingdom. But we learn from Matthew that the kingdom, his church, is here. It's not some future dream, it's a present reality. It's something that we can be a part of. And there's an opportunity here tonight that if there's anyone who's not yet a child of God, there is no better time to put on Christ. And if there's anyone here who is a child of God and would like the prayers of the brethren on their behalf, why don't you come forward as we stand and sing the song of the selected.